Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to the Gypsy Musher. Make sure you check out our website at gypsymusher.com. And on the line calling in from Tok, Alaska, is our host, Hugh Neff. Hugh, how's it going?
Morning, Robert. Just getting everything organized for the race next weekend, and, you know, busy time of year around here this time, but it's enjoyable. It's hard to sleep anymore because you just got so much on your mind, stuff to do.
Well, I know we have a lot of interesting topics to talk about the Yukon Quest, but before we do so, tell us a little bit about the dogs and the training. How's that going?
Doing good. Did a couple of four-hour runs the last couple of days, and have about 18 to 20 dogs that I'm picking through, trying to figure out, you know, maybe there's a few of them that I want to hold back for Iditarod as far as speed leaders or what have you, and trying to figure out what younger dogs it would be a good experience for compared to the veteran dogs that are going to comprise most of the team. So it's like playing poker, you know. It's interesting to try to figure out how to make your best hand.
So when you're doing that, is there anything in particular you're looking for in terms of dogs that are going to stay back? You know, they're out of your pool. You've talked about all year how you've got a supreme team this year. How do you really make the differentiation between who goes and who stays if there's such a fine line between the dogs?
Oh, I don't know. A lot of it's just last-minute attitude, who's eating, who's happy, who's getting along. As far as supreme teams go, I mean, there's in Alaska nowadays, there's dozens of supreme teams. That's the beauty of our sport. There's a lot of quality mushers out there and, you know, fine dogs as well. I'm just going back and forth in my mind because I've acquired half a dozen John Baker dogs, and some of those dogs are looking quite nice. They're a little bit more used to the Iditarod trail, so I might save them for that. Not really sure on that. Fur comes into the equation. The weather report for next week for the race is sounding like it's going to be warm, 20 above. So I got to take that into account. That being said, it's the Quest, so I don't know if I necessarily believe any of the humans' weather reports. Mother Nature always does what she wants to do on the Yukon River. And, you know, it's, you want to have a few young dogs in there. I like their attitude. I like their sense of wonder at seeing the trail for the first time. And I think that's sort of as contagious in the team's attitude. That being said, a lot of my older veteran dogs act like a bunch of little kids, so it'll be fun to put the team together, but just you're not looking for superstars. You're looking to create a machine, and that's what I'm putting together now.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about dogs that are able to do 2,000-mile races pretty much back-to-back within a month? How does that affect a dog doing that many miles in that short of a time? Can you tell us a little bit how the dogs respond to something like that?
Well, I've said it before, and I'll say it again, Robert. You know, compared to humans, year by year, as I've been doing this, I realize how weak we are compared to dogs. I mean, in the old days, we'd sit around and stare at our watches once it hit about 4 or 5 hours, going, oh, those dogs need another hour of rest. They need another hour of rest. They've got to be horribly tired, and we're sitting there by a fire or just trying to stay warm, and it was us who needed the rest more than they did. And the beauty of what we're doing is it's not necessarily about speed. It's just about how you're caring for the animals, the pace that you're keeping them at, and you're just keeping them at a nice quality momentum. You don't want to be flying out of the starting gates. These folks that are all pumped up about who's winning the race the first couple of days, they're not looking at the smaller variables that we as mushers see out on the trail. And a lot of it, you know, is just about keeping the team's energy positive and, you know, taking care of them and preparing for the real race that will start later on down the trail.
There's a recent article out about sled dogs and how they've come to be known as the most extreme athlete in the world in terms of being able to handle stuff like that, you know, the metabolism and that sort of thing. Did you read that article? And if you did, can you share some insight on that?
Yeah, where'd you see that at?
It was some scholarly articles written by a professor or something that says once the dogs get to a particular point, their entire metabolism changes, and no other animal on the planet can do that, and they can just go, you know, for periods of time, being able to outperform just about any animal in terms of distance, as the way that their bodies are designed. Do you know anything about that? I don't have the article here.
Oh, yeah, I'm good. Mike Davis has been doing studies with Allie and Alan and Martin Boozer for, I don't know, half a decade, it seems like, and they've done wonderful research on, you know, the genetics of how these animals are able to perform day in, day out for, you know, not just a 1,000-mile race, but pretty much, you know, for a month straight. You know, they only get about a week off in between races. That being said, you know, I don't know, obviously dogs are an animal that we have a lot of access to. I believe that wolves, I'll take a wolf over a dog as far as endurance any day of the week. If you ever seen wolves on any videos, you know, chasing after animals, or, I mean, there's so much as humans we still have to learn about what all animals are about that I don't really necessarily think dogs are that much better than any other animal on this earth, but they are pretty special when taken care of and nurtured and bonded with properly. And so, yeah, I see where you're coming from as far as it is amazing what they're doing, but a lot of it, I don't think any musher or any dog can just, you know, do this race. It takes a lot of day in and day out, you know, not work but play. It takes a lot of just bonding, and it's an attitude towards life. And there's reasons why the folks that are doing this year in, year out tend to do both races, because we're just obsessed with that feeling of being on the trail, of traveling, of the energy of being one with the earth and going farther than anyone else can even really relate to, you know. Those of us that do all this racing, we're not doing it necessarily, you know, like I said before, for the trophies or the money. We're doing it almost because we feel compelled to do it, because it's so enjoyable. It's like you're connected with, the big man upstairs on an even higher level.
You know, you brought up a great point there about what it takes for a dog to be able to do that, and it brings up the question of nature versus nurture. You talked about play and training and that sort of stuff, which is more nurturing. How much, if at all, does that nurturing interplay with the genetics? Is the genetics overriding in this, or is it the way that we take care of our dogs that is the prevailing point here?
Genetics definitely means a lot. There's reasons why people breed certain leaders or certain dogs. There's a lot of misconceptions out there. I'd say as far as genetics goes, fellows like Martin and Jeff are, you know, those guys. I always imagine those guys had pictures of their dogs on their internet computers with, like, different dogs and the body parts and trying to figure out which legs they should breed with which body and stuff like that. But that's never been my shtick. I breed not only by, you know, the body conformity, but really a lot by the what's upstairs. That's what Lance taught me, is you're breeding as much for head strength as anything. It really is all about heart, and that's how I make my final picks for my race teams. It's about, I can just see it in the dog's eyes. I can see it in their, how they are in their trail, their attitude. I can sort of say, yeah, this her or he or whoever has that attitude that is going to make it for 1,000 miles.
And you've talked to you a whole bunch of times on the show here about the attitude not only that they have with each other, but the attitude that they have with you is often a crucial part in the picking process, is it not?
Oh, definitely. And that doesn't mean that every dog, you know, is totally all over me and licking my face and all that. I got some shyer dogs, like one of my main speed leaders, Tyler. You know, he's a little bit shyer, a little bit more village style, a little houndier. Those hound dogs tend to be a little bit squirrelier in the head. as far as the bond. That was the biggest misconception I had when I got these dogs from John Baker. You know, thinking John's a tough Eskimo. You know, these are going to be really wild Eskimo village dogs, and like Sport and Cots and Savunga and Effie and all these dogs, they're like little sweethearts, and they want to sniff you and lick you and stuff. And I think there's something genetically that definitely makes Huskies more human-like, and that's why. And I've talked with Sebastian and some other folks that have been around the block the last decade, and there is a preference, I think, for long distance to run more of a Husky-style dog as the years go by, because I think they're easier to care for on the trail. And I just, they're, I don't know, their personalities I find more fascinating. And that's why I'm looking forward to this year. Seems I'm going to have a few more Husky-like dogs in it.
So
a little
let's
bit
get...
less of the sprinty type.
Let's get to this race. I know that's the topic for today, the Yukon Quest. We've talked about it the last couple of weeks here on the show, about your food drops and preparing for it. I know you were up in Fairbanks just this past weekend doing the purse party, as they call it, and I would imagine that's where you do your food drops. So you have about a week and a half now before the race. It starts next Saturday in Fairbanks. You shared some interesting news with me right before airtime about what's going to happen in Circle. So let's just start. Let's start with it and tell us what's on your mind about this year's Yukon Quest.
You know, a lot of dog mushing is dealing with human soap operas as well. It's just not what we're doing with the dogs out on the trail. And there's so much that goes into these races. You know, it's 1,000 miles. It's in two different countries. There's a lot of bureaucratic paperwork to deal with and government issues. We received an email this morning via the Quest, and I just got off the phone with my buddy Lance Mackey talking about this with him because I'm really worried about the race now. There's going to be no dog drop at Slavin's Cabin, which is a crucial spot on the trail about halfway between Circle City and Eagle. And it's a 150-mile run, and that means if you have a dog, you know, that gets pooped out or perhaps has a wrist issue or Lord knows what out there, and you're, 20 miles from Circle, that means you have to carry that dog 130 miles. And that's not that big an issue, and the old-time mushers are probably going to say, oh, I've done worse than that in the old days, and you kids don't know. But for me, I'm thinking about not myself, but the overall all the teams of the race. And these newer kids, we got some rookies out there. And I'm not necessarily even worried about them. Whenever in racing, I think all mushers should be worried for all the dogs for the whole field. That's what we should all worry about, their welfare. And basically that dog team is going to have to carry that dog plus the 100-some-odd pounds of weight for this huge run that these people are probably, some of them are going to do a few campouts on. These other mushers. And so that team is going to be exhausted, and that's coming into Eagle, and from Eagle to Dawson, that's one of the hairier stretches of the race as far as the workout goes. So I think it's definitely going to affect the race. Sounds to me, through the grapevine, what I'm hearing is it has to do with FAA, new regulations they have this year, and their Quest is having problems getting pilots to help on the Fairbanks side. I talked to Tamara about it earlier this morning, and I said, hey, if you tell the mushers about this, I'm sure we'd all be willing to put money into it to help find a volunteer pilot to help deal with getting drop dogs, and not necessarily bringing them to Dawson, because I think the governments are having an issue about drop dogs going from one country to another, which is just bureaucracy to me. But if that's the issue, then I don't see why we can't have these drop dogs be flown from Slavin's to Tok or back to Fairbanks. There are going to be government employees manning that cabin from the National Park Service, and bless their souls. They're all friends of mine. They do a great job. They've been doing this for years, and I thank the Park Service for providing this to the race. But for them to be out there and us not to have a dog drop just boggles my mind. It just doesn't make sense, and I hope the Quest can figure this out, because in the end, it's even more important than the Quest or dog racing. It's about the care of the animals, and this is the one dog drop that has more dropped dogs in it than any other dog drop year in, year out, typically. And there's a reason that we drop dogs there, because it's a tough, long run, and we want, you know, the welfare of the dogs is in our, it's what we're, you know, concerned for. So there's still a week and a half to deal with this, and hopefully things can be dealt with. I just hope races, whether it's the Iditarod, the Quest, Copper Basin, what have you, we need to learn to change with the times and not be stuck by paying homage to the past and all about tradition. Because you know what? If you're all about tradition, you're not going to learn how to evolve. And we need to deal with this and move on.
That's a great point that you made there. And we have a question here in the chat, but before I ask that, Hugh, I wanted to get some insight on distances and things to the Slavin's Cabin, I believe you called it. How far is that into the race after you leave Fairbanks?
Oh, after we leave. So you got 300 to circle, and then from circle to Slavin's is usually right in between, I don't know, 75-ish, somewhere in there. It's maybe a little less than that, actually, maybe 60. But
so about,
I guess the question is going to say, well, you can always turn your team around and bring the dog back to circle if you want. But either way, you're going to just have a bad, you know, Robert, I've seen so much in my 11 races in the Quest, and this race for me isn't about the Quest race, and it's about being on that trail and how much I love being out there. And I just know it's a very demanding part of the race. And the beauty of the Quest is if you make it to Dawson going towards Whitehorse, you're going to finish the race probably. It gets, trail gets a lot easier and it's a lot more enjoyable. A little bit of hills to play in, but besides that, it's a little bit more mellow because there's a lot more traffic over there and more mining roads. But this section of trail isn't used as much. And even though the guys putting in the trail do their best, it's still going to be tough no matter what because it's just not traveled as much. So not having this as a dog drop, it's going to make it that much tougher, and that's what I'm concerned for. Not
so
for myself. I mean, I can handle it, man. I'll do it. I'm just thinking about, you know, the whole field.
So let's go to our question from our listener here. It's kind of an interesting question that I'm sure a lot of people wonder about. And he or she says, what happens at the border? Do you have to go through immigration and all that, or is there something special set up for the race?
Yeah, you know, it's just like TSA. We pull into Eagle. We have to take all of our clothes off. They do a body probe on us. And no, I'm just joking, man. We just got a passport, and my buddy Tony from the border there in between Canada and Alaska, he was there last year, and they just, you know, chit-chat. We know a lot of these border folks, most of us mushers, you know, because we're all going back and forth doing races in the Yukon or Alaska. And so they just want to, you know, verify who you are. You also, besides your passport, you have to have copies of all your rabies certificates that you'll keep in the sled with your other information for the race. So it's all, you know, we all know the way paperwork, even though the computer was invented, it seems like paperwork grows by the year in this world. So, and there's a lot of that involved with the Quest as well.
And how far is that into the race from Fairbanks, the border?
The border, so you get the Eagle, that's 450. And then to basically to Dawson, you're going almost 600 miles, depending on the year, from Fairbanks. And then you only have 400 left right around there into Whitehorse. So the border is on the 40-mile river. And it's from Eagle to the 40 miles, 50 miles, and then you take a left, do a Louis, go down the river about 25 miles, and that's where the border is, and they have flags up there, and the rangers usually put up a little logo saying, welcome to Canada, or something like that. And so it's 75 miles from Eagle total.
So let's talk about the differences between the Yukon Quest and the
Excuse me. We don't actually meet the actual Border Patrol there at the on the river there. That's just out in the middle of nowhere. That's just a symbolic deal. We either deal with them in Eagle or in Dawson, depending on who you're dealing with as far as the border, whether it's the RCMPs in Dawson or the troopers in Eagle. So. We don't actually, you know, these people aren't waiting for us out in the middle of nowhere. They're going to be in one of the areas that are, you know, civilized.
So let's talk a little bit about the differences between the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. I know you've told me several times that you enjoy the trail and the experience of the Quest a little bit better than the Iditarod. What are some of the main differences, not only in the terrain and the race itself, but possibly checkpoints, how handlers can help you, that sort of thing? Can you give us a rundown for people that may not know the differences?
Well, first of all, let me put it this way. Every year you have Quest mushers doing the Iditarod year after year. How many Iditarod mushers do you see doing the Quest year after year? The Quest is a tougher mental race, I believe. I think you have to deal with, issues as far as organizing more because you've got longer runs between checkpoints. And the Iditarod is more of a systematic speed endurance race, where the Quest, there's a lot more variables as far as being on your own. You're not going to be keying off of other mushers as much because it's basically you, the dogs, and the land. You'll go stretches, for the Quest last year until I fell apart on Eagle Summit. I didn't see another musher for close to a week, man. It was one of those events that'll probably never happen again. It was just crazy out there. So I did around here. Always, it's a circus, lots of media, lots of helicopters, planes, all that sort of stuff. Quest, you don't see much out there for long stretches of time. And that's the beauty of it for many of us. We love it. That's what we live for. And it's historically, I don't know, there's a lot of Gold Rush lore in the north, but there's just something really special about that area between Eagle and Dawson, and you just get a vibe off the land, and it's a pretty special event. That being said, I love the Iditarod as well. There's a reason why I do so much racing. I can't, every year it seems like I just can't get enough of it. And I'm usually pretty exhausted a few weeks before the race, but once you get closer to that race, man, I could barely sleep because I'm just pumped up to get out there and play.
And how can handlers or your support team help you out on the Quest? I know they can't do it at all on Iditarod.
Well, this year it's going to be awesome, man. I got like a whole group of folks that are coming from all different parts of the country to help out in Hawaii, Washington, Carolina, and it's going to be, what they're doing basically is either helping out in the beginning. My buddy John Larson's going to be driving the truck to Circle, and they'll take care of cleaning up your site, raking up all the straw. Handlers actually have a meeting they have to go to before the race because they don't do these certain functions, we actually get fined. And so they have to gather up all your extra bags that you don't use. So if you do have extra bags, you're not losing that stuff. You can actually use that for a race later on in the year. And then, of course, if you have any drop dogs, they'll pick them up as well. So for the Quest, it's a lot more demanding on the handler. Iditarod is just like, see you later at the finish line, and we'll talk to you in Nome, hopefully, if all goes well. Where the Quest, that handler is going to be with you throughout the race. They can sort of guard your team when the team is resting. They're really not allowed to touch or play with the dogs, or else you'd have, every team would have three or four women out there, loving up the dogs for you, and that's taboo. You're not allowed to do that, except for Dawson. In Dawson, they're allowed to do whatever they like as far as caring for them for the 36-hour break in Dawson. And you set up a little tent enclosure, open aired on each side. You put a bunch of straw down. You have tons of food, and you're just loving them up. You can take them on walks. They go over, not only every checkpoint, but the veterinary crew, you have your yellow book that they're going to be going through each dog's name and going over all their different body parts, checking their heart rate, making sure that they're a healthy animal. And they're going to let you know. And believe me, I've learned this throughout the years in racing. If you're a newer musher, the veterinarian tells you during Iditarod or the Quest, hey, you might want to keep an eye on that dog. Keep an eye on that dog, because that veterinarian, I used to have an attitude against vets, and I'm not going to lie about it. My first couple of years, and I've seen it in other mushers, where a veterinarian veterinarians will be like, you're having an issue with this dog or that dog, and you want to tell them, hey, you don't know my kid. You haven't lived with me every day with this animal. But you know what? There's a reason why these people went to 8 years of college. They know a lot more about your dog probably than you do as far as its condition. So keep an open mind, I'd say, as a musher to veterinarians and their opinions of what you need to do with your animals. And in the long run, you know, it's the coolest part about mushing, I'd say, is to pull into a checkpoint and not just impress the, you know, the race fans, but if you get the veterinarians going, that's a nice-looking team, it makes you feel really good. And I've been lucky enough to do that a few times the last couple of years.
And in both, I don't know about the Yukon Quest, but I do know in Iditarod and many mid-distance races, they have awards or recognition for that, best-kept team and that sort of thing because of that. Of course, this is all about the dogs, but we want to make sure that the dogs are very well cared for, and that's why we pay so much attention.
Those awards are awards are great. A lot of us, not a lot of us, but there are very well-known championship Iditarod mushers that I've spoken with, and sorry, my other phone's going off in the background, that we don't necessarily agree with these awards. We like the award. We think it represents a good thing. We just don't believe it should be given to one musher, because how are you going to say one musher's better than other mushers to taking care of their dog teams? I mean, I believe you could give out 10 or 15 of these awards, and I think it'd be better that way, actually, because if they gave out 10 or 15 of these veterinarian awards and you're one of the mushers that didn't get that award, you would be thinking even more, what am I not doing to take care of my dogs better? Where if they just give it to one musher, you start wondering, well, I wonder if that musher is best friends with the head vet, or how'd they get that award, you know? So these vet awards are great. It's great that people are donating prizes for them, but I think the real award for any of us as mushers is, you know, just to look on our dogs' faces at the end of the race and say, hey, boss, we just did something pretty special.
Speaking of awards and prizes, I know last year in the Iditarod, you received the real fancy meal from the Millennium. I don't recall the checkpoint where you got that, but is there anything like that? Where was it?
That was in Anvik.
In Anvik. Is there anything like that?
I enjoyed the award. I don't know if I'm necessarily going to try to get that award again, though.
Are there any kind
not
of
not a good
award?
Idea to be drinking a glass of wine at 6:30 in the morning.
A week into the race, for sure, where you're just exhausted. Are there any things like that in the Yukon Quest, whether they're giving out gold or any type of special award like that? Maybe not a big deal for you guys, but at least it's kind of cool that the fans know about these sorts of things. Is there anything like that?
Yeah, and I've talked with Quest people in the past, and I've thought that they should have almost an award per checkpoint and don't necessarily make it for the team that comes in first, say, have a local kid draw out of a hat, and the team that comes in, say, fifth or whatever that child picks, they get, you know, 500 booties from someone or dog food or whatever. I mean, I think it'd be the more, you know, we make these races, I think, like a celebration, like a Mardi Gras of dog mushing instead of just a competition between the top three teams or what have you. I think it keeps it more interesting not only for all the fans but all the mushers too. And there's a lot of you know, races within the race for teams trying to come in fifth or seventh or whatever place. So they do have the Golden Dawson. The fellers have been donating that for eons now, and that's a nice thing that they do, and it's a good representation of the area and what the mining activity is like and all that. It's pretty big time right now in the Yukon, and obviously with the price of gold and everything, but I don't think any of us, you know, if you're all about getting the gold in Dawson, then you've forgotten about the other 400 miles of race trail. So something to shoot for maybe in the moment, but I don't think it's what you start the race thinking, I've got to get that gold in Dawson. That's not a good way to be racing the Quest.
How much gold is it, Hugh?
Oh, you're trying to get me on this one. I think it's 4 ounces, I believe. So
that's a
I'm
nice
not
chunk
totally
of change.
Positive on that.
That so what
it's,
is
it's
that?
A, it's at least
$5,000 or so.
Yeah. It's a bit of money to play with, but you know, money comes, money goes. It's the experience, what it's all about. So.
You mentioned that you would like to make it more of a celebration in terms of fans being involved and that sort of thing. Of course, you talked about just a couple of minutes ago about how much coverage there is of the Iditarod, and you know, people fly into checkpoints, and I know they have a special deal at Iditarod.com where you can, you know, pretty much buy a pass to be, you know, on the sled with the musher, as well as to fly into Rainy Pass for the checkpoint. What type of spots do you have like that on the Yukon Quest where people can, you know, welcome you at the checkpoints? I know it's a much more rural, mountainous type trail compared to a lot of the Iditarod trail. Where can people see you guys, you know, really cheer you guys on instead of the start and the finish?
Yeah, well, if I was a race fan that had time to spend and could afford a plane ticket, I would without question go to Dawson City. That's where it's all, I mean, every year that's why we do the quest. It's just like, it's one of those three sister cities, I call them, Skagway, Dawson, and Nome. And there's just something special about those places, and we love going there. It's just it's like going back in time. All the buildings are like in the Gold Rush era, and not all of them, but most of them. And, you know, it's just a special area of the race, and you can get a vehicle, and you can actually follow from checkpoint to checkpoint from there all the way into the finish line if you wanted to, which would be about, you know, 3 days. And that's a good way to see the race. I forgot what the other part of your question was.
Oh, no, I was just asking where fans can participate in the race as fans.
Oh, where... As far as participating, the last few years, the Quest have had a sort of Iditarider type of auction for the beginning of the race where a person can donate a bit of money and come and hang out with the mushers and go up to the starting line with them and take a picture and everything. And it's pretty inexpensive. That's just a couple hundred bucks, I believe. And that's a good way to support the Quest as well. Yeah, if you're a fan of the Quest, you've probably been around the block and you know the places to go to. There's areas. 101 is a big spot. My buddy Dick Ellsworth over at Ivory Jacks has been running and donating that spot for years. Peter Camper runs it. And that's a great place to see teams go over Eagle Summit. And, you know, the Iditarod is huge in the U.S., but you have to realize internationally, the Quest is huge. That's the funny thing. I don't think Americans even realize that. That you go to Japan, you go to Germany. William Clayton and I did a German TV show a few years back. They aired it over Easter weekend in Germany, and it had 65 million viewing audience.
Holy
so Japan, I did a video with a Japanese film crew a couple years ago with Lance and Hans, and that was huge there. They ended up making a game show out of it. So just because the Quest ain't that big in the U.S. doesn't mean it's not big in other parts of the world. And it's got a pretty decent following in the U.S. too, I'm sure, through the internet.
So we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and just to bring it to a head again in terms of time, when do you project the first group of folks are going to start getting into Whitehorse after they leave next Saturday? What's a pretty good guess for that?
Oh, I would have no clue, dude. No clue at all. I ain't even going to go that way. That's just
okay.
Messing with the big guy upstairs, and I don't think the great almighty likes humans to be too cocky. I've learned not to dare Mother Nature anymore. She tends to beat the crap out of me. But I would, you know, 9-10 days, who knows? That 36-hour layover tends to make the race a little bit longer. People don't realize that mileage-wise, year in, year out, the Quest is actually might be a few miles longer than Iditarod. But as far as gauging the miles in these races, it's hard to do because when they do it, they're not really including miles that go up and down. And the Quest has a lot of those as well.
My last question about the Quest, and then I want to talk about the sled dog of the week, which is Geronimo, and he has a special place in your heart and what happened last year on the Quest. But the 36-hour layover, I know there's a 24-hour layover in the Iditarod. A day and a half is a long time to be at a particular checkpoint taking care of dogs and all that sort of stuff. What happens during that time? If you can tell us about that for the fans out there, you know, sitting at one, and you're not sitting, but you're pretty much stationary for a day and a half. What happens during that time?
Oh, I'm not stationary, dude. You know me. I'm too hyper for that. I get a little break, try to go over to downtown, has a nice jacuzzi that I'll try to use at the annex there. For me, you know, I'm a eternal tourist, so I've got to go, if I can, take a quick run up to the top of the hill and see where Jack London and Robert Service used to live, two of my heroes. And then, you know, the Pit's like a famous old bar at the bottom of the downtown hotel that has a just almost a haunted feeling to it. It's a pretty amazing place. We all go in there and have a celebratory cerveza, and we have meetings. There's tons of stuff going on in Dawson during that time. And then, of course, you know, you're caring for the dogs, walking them. They do need a lot of rest, though, so you're not, like, you know, pushing them too hard. Even though I heard the year that Nate Dew did the race, Andre, when he came in second to Bruce Lee, that his dogs, he actually ran up and down the parking area there along the river because they were just used to being run every day. It shows you how tough these dogs are.
Wow.
Even though his dogs were more of a slow trotter than a runner, from what I heard. Never had the opportunity to race against them. There's plenty to do. It flies by in a second. I personally think it's a little bit too long. Even the 24-hour deal in Iditarod, I think, you know, it's logistically a nightmare, and there's a reason why they do it all in one chunk like this, but I think it'd be neater in a way for the race if they made it, like, say Iditarod, instead of a 24-hour layover, make it two 12-hour layovers, or in the Quest, instead of 36 hours, make it 12 in Circle, or, you know, in 24 in Dawson, or divided up somehow, or, you know, something to that effect. But I guess for the folks who are doing all the mathematical logistics, it might be a little bit over their head, or I don't know why they haven't thought of that, but I know of a lot of other mushers that would probably back me up on that as well. But there's plenty to do in Dawson in 36 hours, so that's probably another reason why they tend to do it there every year, because it's a pretty special place, that's for sure.
And with 400 miles to go, it's nothing to sneeze at after you leave. 400 miles is 400 miles.
Yeah, and it's a workout. Lots of hills there going to Scroggy, and, you know, it's what we live for, though. There's nothing like getting to the top of the mountain covered in sweat, you know, breathing heavy. Your body feels like a big muscle, and you're just still so full and alive and just lots of vim and vigor. And you stop the team, and all the dogs look back at you, and they're barely even breathing hard. And it just shows you how much tougher they are than you are. So, yeah.
And, you know, that's a pretty
amazing race in that way.
That description is a great definition for the Gypsy Musher, and I'm sure people listening in their cubicles or on their iPods are thinking, wow, how must it feel to be truly alive like that? And that's what we live for, all of us mushers. It's that experience. It's not, you know, the politics and that sort of thing that's involved. It's that feeling of being so alive, isn't it?
Oh, it really is, man. And, yeah, you treasure your existence on this earth, especially after what happened with me and Geronimo Passon at Eagle Summit last year. You know, that was easily the most difficult thing I've ever had to deal with. And this race definitely is all about him. And
well, let's talk a little bit about Geronimo. He is our featured sled dog of the week. This is something that you hold close to, and you're paying memory to him on your hoodies that you can get at gypsymusher.com and that sort of thing. Tell us a little bit about Geronimo. I'm sure a lot of people have read about him and heard about him over the past year on Facebook and that sort of thing. What made this dog so special to you, Hugh?
Oh, they all are. You know that. But he just had that special, I've got, you know, so many special dogs that I try not to make one favorite, you know, but his sister is actually in the team. You know, he was one of Annie's army, and he still is. And her name is Juanita, and she looks exactly like him, pretty much, the facial markings. A little bit different, but She'll be in the team this year along with Jewel and her brothers and sisters, Amigo, George. And their Annie's the mom, of course, and they've got that Annie attitude. Very dominant. Geronimo wasn't necessarily a friendly dog, you know. He was a fighter. He was a scrapper. And you got to be careful, you know, because, you know, those dogs, these aren't typical, you know, couch potato pet dogs, you know. They've got attitude. They all want to be the king of the pack and all that. But just a lover, you know, always wanted to jump up and hug you. And he's definitely in my thoughts pretty much, you know, every day.
How old was he when he passed, Hugh?
They're all going on 4 now, so he's about 3.
Okay, all right.
And a big thank you to that, with that situation. People don't realize it, but the person that helped me out the most was actually Ken Anderson's wife.
Wow. So, and how did she help you out?
Just, you know, when the scene happened, it was a tough situation, so.
You know,
it's nice to have somebody there.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Last year, when all this went down, I remember you and I talked, and it may have even been on our short little interview at the Iditarod, about changes that may need to be taken place in the Yukon Quest because of things like this. Do you still agree with that here a year later?
Yeah, but realistically, the people who think that they own the spirit of this race aren't going to evolve is the way I look at it. I've been dealing with this for years. I've tried to, you know, put in a good word, but unfortunately there's a few negative people in this world we all know can ruin it for everybody. And if those people know how to twist the English language into their favor, they're going to do so. They're all, you know, have that verbosity, that somewhat like Al Swearengen and the TV series Deadwood. They just know how to use the language to promote their causes. And the Quest is an amazing race, amazing trail. And somewhere back in, you know, the early years, they put the word tough in there. They wanted to call it the toughest race on earth. And believe me, for a guy who has done a bit more than most, being tough isn't necessarily being smart. And
right.
So, you know, hopefully these races will learn that they have to evolve and go with the times, not necessarily change the race and alter it that much, but they have to do what's best for the field as a whole. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in Iditarod this year? I'm not going to come out here and say anything right now in the air before anything's said about it, but there's rumors that parts of the Iditarod trail might be changed. So if other races can do it, I don't see why the Quest can't either. But as of now, next year, I'm planning on not doing the Quest for the first time since 2004, and I'll be going to Unalakleet and racing over there. And if they have another race there next year, they're having a race there in a couple of weeks to honor Paul Johnson, who was an Iditarod musher from that area that passed away, unfortunately, a few months ago. So,
Well, you know, Hugh,
whatever happens, happens, and if people think that forcing a dog team to march into a 50-mile-an-hour blizzard up a 4,000-foot mountain after going 700 miles and then going through 3 feet of open water for 40 minutes at 50 below is a good thing, then that's my deal with that whole situation. I've had all these old-time mushers telling me what I should have done and how I need to train dogs, how to get up mountains properly, and I just want to look at these guys and just go, you know what, you're not me, and you never will be. So I was there in that moment, and I obviously went through the horror, and I just hope to God that nobody has to be in a situation like I was.
Well, you know, to end this, Hugh, this show was a tribute to Geronimo. It is almost a year after that time. And you know, like you and I have talked about the entire time that we've been doing this show, it is all about the dogs. And who cares about the politics and all that? If the dogs don't come first, it's not worth doing. At least in my book, how is it to you?
Oh, you know, we we all would like that, but this is you know, competition, and it is a business for many of these folks, and a lot of these guys, this is all they think about is winning. I mean, it's funny to listen to some of these Iditarod mushers before the race starts, and you could just, they're just saying it out loud even sometimes, saying, I got to win this race, and you look at them like they're a little bit goofy in the head or something, because this isn't what this whole thing was created for. It's great to do your best and to try to win, but you know what, if all of us are all about winning, that means that besides the person that wins the race, the rest of us are all just a bunch of losers. So, you know, it's got to be more to dog mushing than, you know, just getting that first place trophy. And that's the, you know, the beauty of a guy like Lance or John Baker or some of these other guys. Even when they don't win, they're still champions in my mind just because of their attitude towards dog mushing. And they're not doing it necessarily to win the race. They just want to get better at what they do. That's why I come back every year. I'd like to win, but, you know, I'm just doing this because I want to get better at what I love to do.
My last question to you, Hugh, and I know we're recording, we're streaming live now if people are listening. I've known you for 3-4 years now. I've seen some changes in you and how you approach things, at least when you and I talk. Are you a much better musher in the last 3 or 4 years than you were before that?
Well, I've definitely learned from the School of Hard Knocks. I think what I've learned the most is to realize as a human how stupid you are and to keep asking questions and keep trying to I don't care if you're 8 years old or 80 years old, there's always something new to figure out. So I think that's my biggest deal, is I'm just not satisfied with how I do things. And when I'm running a team down the trail, I'm not talking about how great my dogs are. I'm constantly looking for problems. I'm looking for weaknesses. I'm looking to see who I need to switch around or who looks a little sluggish or, you know, what have you. So, and I do the same with myself. But, yeah, I don't know if I'm necessarily a better musher. I just think I'm getting a little bit older, and that's why a lot of your top mushers are in their 40s and 50s, because they've been playing chess a little bit longer as far as dog mushing goes.
So UConn Quest starts a week from this Saturday. Are we planning on a show before you go, or we wait until afterwards?
No, we can try to figure out one. I got the banquets next Wednesday. Then we got Meet the Mushers on Thursday. I'm doing a couple school talks in Fairbanks as well. But we'll figure out a way to get you in there, perhaps on Friday, the day before, Robert.
So there we go. So look forward to us, gypsymusher.com, for next editions on next Friday. Make sure you follow Hugh and the gang on Gypsy Musher on Facebook and Twitter. We do get a lot of good questions and comments on Facebook as well. So, Hugh, you know you have a lot of fans out there. A lot of people are supporting you just by the fact that you said a whole bunch of folks are coming up to help you out during this UConn Quest. And I'm sure a lot of those guys you've met as fans. So I'm sure they're looking forward to it. I spoke to Bruce just yesterday on Facebook Messenger, and he's very excited to be up there with you guys during the quest and the Iditarod as well. So, Hugh, you got a lot of support back there, buddy, so I'm sure everything's going to work out. Anything else you want to say in closing?
Yeah, thanks to everybody as far as those guys, Bruce and Jaime and everyone that's helping out, and special thanks to Tamara, too. She's always, you know, a big part of Laughing Eyes Kennel, and she'll hopefully be in Dawson this year, so not only to help the kennel, but she's actually on the board of the UConn side of the Quest, and if the Quest was smart, they'd use her knowledge and expertise, because she's good at creating not only better people, but better organizations, and Lord knows she's helped out in my career, that's for sure.
Very good. So, Hugh, we'll talk again next week, and until next time, stay safe out there, and we'll see everybody on the trail, okay?
All right. Peace, brother.
Take care. So this is Robert Forto on behalf of our host, Hugh Neff, Iditarod and UConn Quest veteran. Make sure you check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Again, just search Gypsy Musher. Until next time, goodbye.